Chapter 17. There should have been a poet in our company to describe that charming little bay of Glaucus, into which we entered on the 26th of September, in the first steamboat that ever disturbed its beautiful waters. You can't put down in prose that delicious episode of natural poetry. It ought to be done in a symphony, full of sweet melodies and swelling harmonies, or sung in a strain of clear crystal iambics, such as Milnes knows how to write. A mere map, drawn in words, gives the mind no notion of that exquisite nature. What do mountains become in type, or rivers in Mr. Visitelli's best brevier? Here lies the sweet bay, gleaming peaceful in the rosy sunshine. Green islands dip here and there in its waters. Purple mountains swell circling round it, and towards them, rising from the bay, stretches a rich green plain, fruitful with herbs and various foliage, in the midst of which the white houses twinkle. I can see a little minaret, and some spreading palm trees, but, beyond these, the description would answer as well for Bantry Bay as for Macri. You could write so far, nay, much more particularly and grandly, without seeing the place at all, and after reading Beaufort's Aromania, which gives you not the least notion of it. Suppose the great hydrographer of the Admiralty himself can't describe it, who surveyed the place. Suppose Mr. Fellows, who discovered it afterwards, suppose, I say, Sir John Fellows, K.N.T. comma can't do it, and I defy any man of imagination to got an impression of Tolmessus from his book. Can you, vain man, hope to try? The effect of the artist, as I take it, ought to be, to produce upon his hearer's mind, by his art, an effect something similar to that produced on his own by the sight of the natural object. Only music, or the best poetry, can do this. Keats, the To the Grecian Urn, is the best description I know of that sweet old silent ruin of Tolmessus. After you have once seen it, the remembrance remains with you, like a tune from Mozart, which he seems to have caught out of heaven, and which rings sweet harmony in your ears forever after. It's a benefit for all afterlife. You have but to shut your eyes, and think, and recall it, and the delightful vision comes smiling back, to your order, the divine air, the delicious little pageant, which nature set before you on this lucky day. Here is the entry made in the notebook on the eventful day. And the morning steamed into the Bay of Glaucus, landed at Macri, cheerful old desolate village theater by the beautiful seashore, great fertility, Olander's a palm tree in the midst of the village, spreading out like a sultan's aigrette, sculptured caverns, or tombs, up the mountain camels over the bridge. Perhaps it is best for a man of fancy to make his own landscape out of these materials. To group the couched camels under the plane trees, the little crowd of wandering ragged heathens come down to the calm water, to behold the nearing steamer, to fancy a mountain, in the sides of which some scores of tombs are rudely carved, pillars and porticos, and Doric entablatures. But it is of the little theater that he must make the most beautiful picture, a charming little place of festival, lying out on the shore, and looking over the sweet bay and the swelling purple islands. No theater goer ever looked out on a fairer scene. It encourages poetry, idleness, delicious sensual reverie. O. Jones, friend of my heart, would you not like to be a white-robed Greek, lolling languidly on the cool benches here, and pouring compliments in the Ionic dialect into the rosy ears of Neaera? Instead of Jones, your name should be Ionites. Instead of a silk hat, you should wear a chaplet of roses in your hair. You would not listen to the choruses they were singing on the stage, for the voice of the fair one would be whispering a rendezvous for the Mezonuctias Horace, and my Ionites would have no ear for aught beside. Yonder, in the mountain, they would carve a Doric cave temple, to receive your urn when all was done, and you would be accompanied thither by a dirge of the surviving Ionity. The caves of the dead are empty now, however, and their place knows them not any more among the festal haunts of the living. But, by way of supplying the choric melodies sung here in old time, one of our companions mounted on the scene and spouted, "My name is Norval. On the same day we lay to for a while at another ruined theater, that of Antiphilos. The Oxford men, fresh with recollections of the little go, bounded away up the hill on which it lies to the ruin, measured the steps of the theater, and calculated the width of the scene, while others, less active, watched them with telescopes from the ship's sides, as they plunged in and out of the stones and hollows. 2 days after, the scene was quite changed. We were out of sight of the classical country, and lay in St. George's Bay, behind a huge mountain, upon which St. George fought the dragon, and rescued the lovely Lady Sabra, the king of Babylon's daughter. The Turkish fleet was lying about us, commanded by that Halil Pasha whose two children the two last sultans murdered. The crimson flag, with the star and crescent, floated at the stern of his ship. Our diplomatist put on his uniform and cordons, and paid His Excellency a visit. He spoke in rapture, when he returned, of the beauty and order of the ship, and the urbanity of the infidel admiral. He sent us bottles of ancient Cyprus wine to drink, and the captain of Her Majesty's ship, Rump, alongside which we were lying, confirmed that good opinion of the Captain Pasha which the reception of the above present led us to entertain, by relating many instances of his friendliness and hospitalities. Captain G said the Turkish ships were as well manned, as well kept, and as well maneuvered, as any vessels in any service, and intimated a desire to command a Turkish 74, and a perfect willingness to fight her against a French ship of the same size. But I heartily trust he will neither embrace the Mahometan opinions, nor be called upon to engage any 74 whatever. If he do, let us hope he will have his own men to fight with. If the crew of the Trump were all like the crew of the captain's boat, they need fear no 250 men out of any country, with any Joinville at their head. We were carried on shore by this boat. For 2 years, during which the Rump had been lying off Beirut, none of the men, but these 8 had ever set foot on shore. Mustn't it be a happy life? We were landed at the busy quay of Beirut, flanked by the castle that the fighting old commodore half battered down. Along the Beirut quay civilization flourishes under the flags of the consuls, which are streaming out over the yellow buildings, in the clear air. Hither she brings from England her produce of marine stores and woolens, her crockeries, her portable soups, and her bitter ale. Hither she has brought politeness, and the last modes from Paris. They were exhibited in the person of a pretty lady, superintending the great French store, and who, seeing a stranger sketching on the quay, sent forward a man with a chair to accommodate that artist, and greeted him with a bow and a smile, such as only can be found in France. Then she fell to talking with a young French officer with a beard, who was greatly smitten with her. They were making love just as they do on the boulevard. An Arab porter left his bales, and the camel he was unloading, to come and look at the sketch. Two stumpy flat-faced Turkish soldiers, in red caps and white undresses, peered over the paper. A noble little Lebanonian girl, with a deep yellow face, and curly dun-colored hair, and a blue tattooed chin, and for all clothing a little ragged shift of blue cloth, stood by like a little statue, holding her urn, and stared with wondering brown eyes. How magnificently blue the water was, how bright the flags and buildings as they shone above it, and the lines of the rigging tossing in the bay. The white crests of the blue waves jumped and sparkled like quicksilver. The shadows were as broad and cool as the lights were brilliant and rosy. The battered old towers of the Commodore looked quite cheerful in the delicious atmosphere, and the mountains beyond were of an amethyst color. The French officer and the lady went on chattering quite happily about love, the last new bonnet, or the Battle of Islay, or the Euphrates. How neatly her gown and sleeves fitted her pretty little person. We had not seen a woman for a month, except honest Mrs. Flanagan, the stewardess, and the ladies of our party, and the tips of the noses of the Constantinople beauties as they passed, by leering from their yakmaks, waddling, and clapping in their odious yellow papooshes. And this day is to be marked with a second white stone, for having given the lucky writer of the present occasion to behold a second beauty. This was a native Syrian damsel, who bore the sweet name of Miriam. So it was she stood as two of us. I mentioned the number for fear of scandal, took her picture. So it was that the good-natured black cook looked behind her young mistress, with a benevolent grin, that only the admirable Leslie could paint. Miriam was the sister of the young guide whom we hired to show us through the town, and to let us be cheated in the purchase of gilt scarfs and handkerchiefs, which strangers think proper to buy. And before the following authentic drawing could be made, many were the stratagems the wily artists were obliged to employ, to subdue the shyness of the little Miriam. In the first place, she would stand behind the door from which in the darkness her beautiful black eyes gleamed out like penny tapers, nor could the entreaties of her brother and mama bring her from that hiding place. In order to conciliate the latter, we began by making a picture of her to that is, not of her, who was an enormous old fat woman in yellow, quivering all over with strings of pearls, and necklaces of sequins, and other ornaments, the which descended from her neck, and down her ample stomacher. We did not depict that big old woman, who would have been frightened at an accurate representation of her own enormity, but an ideal being, all grace and beauty, dressed in her costume, and still simpering before me in my sketchbook like a lady in a book of fashions. This portrait was shown to the old woman, who handed it over to the black cook, who, grinning, carried it to little Miriam, and the result was, that the young creature stepped forward, and submitted, and has come over to Europe as you see. 2. A very snug and happy family did this of Miriam's appear to be. If you could judge by all the laughter and giggling, by the splendor of the women's attire, by the neatness of the little house, prettily decorated with arabesque paintings, neat mats, and gay carpets, they were a family well to do in the bare-out world, and lived with as much comfort as any Europeans. They had one book, and, on the wall of the principal apartment, a black picture of the Virgin, whose name is borne by pretty Miriam. The camels and the soldiers, the bazaars and khans, the fountains and awnings, which checker, with such delightful variety of light and shade, the alleys and markets of an oriental town, are to be seen in bare-out in perfection, and an artist might here employ himself for months with advantage and pleasure. A new costume was here added to the motley and picturesque assembly of dresses. This was the dress of the blue-veiled women from the Lebanon, stalking solemnly through the markets, with huge horns, near a yard high, on their foreheads. For thousands of years, since the time the Hebrew prophets wrote, these horns have so been exalted in the Lebanon. At night Captain Lewis gave a splendid ball and supper to the trump. We had the trump's band to perform the music, and a grand sight it was to see the captain himself enthusiastically leading on the drum. Blue lights and rockets were burned from the yards of our ship, which festive signals were answered presently from the trump, and from another English vessel in the harbor. They must have struck the Capitan Pasha with wonder, for he sent his secretary on board of us to inquire what the fireworks meant. And the worthy Turk had scarcely put his foot on the deck, when he found himself seized round the waist by one of the trump's officers, and whirling round the deck in a waltz, to his own amazement, and the huge delight of the company. His face of wonder and gravity, as he went on twirling, could not have been exceeded by that of a dancing dervish at Scutari, and the manner in which he managed to enjammer the waltz excited universal applause. I forgot whether he accommodated himself to European ways, so much further, as to drink champagne at supper time. To say that he did, would be telling tales out of school, and might interfere with the future advancement of that jolly dancing Turk. We made acquaintance with another of the Sultan's subjects, who, I fear, will have occasion to doubt of the honor of the English nation, after the foul treachery with which he was treated. Among the occupiers of the little bazaar matchboxes, vendors of embroidered handkerchiefs and other articles of showy Eastern haberdashery, was a good-looking neat young fellow, who spoke English very fluently, and was particularly attentive to all the passengers on board our ship. This gentleman was not only a pocket handkerchief merchant in the bazaar, but earned a further livelihood by letting out mules and donkeys, and he kept a small lodging house, or inn, for travelers, as we were informed. No wonder he spoke good English, and was exceedingly polite and well-bred, for the worthy man had passed some time in England, and in the best society too. That humble haberdasher at Beirut had been a lion here, at the very best houses of the great people, and had actually made his appearance at Windsor, where he was received as a Syrian prince, and treated with great hospitality by royalty itself. I don't know what waggish propensity moved one of the officers of the Rump to say that there was an equerry of His Royal Highness the Prince on board, and to point me out as the dignified personage in question. So the Syrian prince was introduced to the royal equerry, and a great many compliments passed between us. I even had the audacity to state that on my very last interview with my royal master, His Royal Highness had said, "Colonel Titmarsh, when you go to Beirut, you will make special inquiries regarding my interesting friend Khoja Hassan." Poor Khoja Hassan, I forget whether that was his name, but it is as good as another, was overpowered with this royal message, and we had an intimate conversation together, at which the waggish officer of the Rump assisted with the greatest glee. But see the consequences of deceit. The next day, as we were getting underway, who should come on board, but my friend the Syrian prince, most eager for a last interview with the Windsor equerry, and he begged me to carry his protestations of unalterable fidelity to the gracious consort of Her Majesty. Nor was this all. Khoja Hassan actually produced a great box of sweetmeats, of which he begged my excellency to accept, and a little figure of a doll dressed in the costume of Lebanon. Then the punishment of imposture began to be felt severely by me. How to accept the poor devil's sweetmeats? How to refuse them? And as we know that one fib leads to another, so I was obliged to support the first falsehood by another, and putting on a dignified air, "Khoja Hassan," says I am surprised you don't know the habits of the British court better, and are not aware that our gracious master solemnly forbids his servants to accept any sort of backsheesh upon our travels. So Prince Khoja Hassan went over the side with his chest of sweetmeats, but insisted on leaving the doll, which may be worth 2 pence halfpenny, of which, and of the costume of the women of Lebanon, the following is an accurate likeness. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.